Lake Effect Now. I'm Mitch Teich. One of public radio's iconic names made news recently when he announced he's at least entertaining the thought of retiring. Garrison Keillor told, of all sources, the AARP Bulletin, that he'd like to retire as host of a Prairie Home Companion in the spring of 2013. That's provided he can find a replacement. To many listeners, it's impossible to imagine anyone else doing what Keillor does, but every week on the Canadian equivalent of public radio, the CBC, there is a variety show in which the host tells the stories of a group of likable but occasionally flawed fictional characters, welcomes musical groups to the stage, and travels to far-flung communities to reach audiences. We're not suggesting that Stuart McLean should be Garrison Keillor's successor, but we are suggesting he's a storyteller worth knowing about. His work is collected in a series of short story books about his characters, including Dave, the proprietor of the Vinyl Cafe, which bills itself as the world's smallest record shop, and his wife, Morley. McLean's show is called The Vinyl Cafe. The setting is the modern-day Toronto area, but there is something vintage about the way people in McLean's stories treat each other. Nicely. Stuart McLean joins us now via Skype from his office in Toronto. Thanks so much for being with us.
It's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
I wonder if you could address the idea of sentimentality in your stories. It seems like the idea of a record shop, the appreciation of music on vinyl, feels like maybe it's a metaphor for the way neighborhoods, communities used to be, that there's something more to a record than music or something more to a community than proximity. Is sentimentality a bad way to put that?
It's the stories are definitely about connection and neighborhood. That's for sure. One of the reasons I write the way I do is to remind people of the goodness in the world, but not just the world gone by. The world is maybe even more so the world as we know it now. We don't need to be reminded of the good old days. But I think there's a lot going on around us. There are many people at work around us to remind us of the hard times that we're going through and the tough things about life and the disappointments of life. But there aren't that many people who are reminding us of the goodness of people. I think that people largely are good and well-intentioned and want to help others. Those are some of the feelings and events that I want to shine the light on in my stories. And if that makes them sentimental, then yes, they're sentimental. But I've always been confused with what people mean when they say sentimental. I really should haul out the dictionary. I know it's a slag, but if it means full of feelings, my stories, there are feelings in my stories, and I'm certainly not ashamed of that. I have no sentimental attachment to the past, but I have strong feelings about telling people that the world is a good place. I think the Desiderata had it right. You know, despite all its sham and drudgery, the world is a beautiful place.
I want to introduce people to Dave. Is one of the characters that the Vinyl Cafe stories revolve around. He's the owner of the record store of the same name, the self-proclaimed world's smallest record store. How well do you feel like you knew Dave when it started, and how well do you know him now?
A guy was once interviewing me and asked if he told me that Dave was in the next room, would I want to go and meet him? Which was a question that floored me because he was my imaginary friend. This is a guy I've written about for almost 20 years, and I was pulled up completely short because one would think that, of course, you'd want to meet him. And I was horrified with the idea because I think I was afraid it would be horribly awkward that I would walk in, and what if I didn't like him? What if there was something about him I had missed completely? Writing about him is like getting to know a person. You know, at first you don't know him all that well, and the more and more you write about him, the more and more you know about him. But I am always left with this feeling that after doing it 17 years, you can start thinking about, well, this is going to end someday. And it fills me with panic because I feel like I really haven't scratched the surface. I know him better and better, yet I hardly know him at all.
In some ways, writing these stories must be a little like what kids get out of playing with dollhouses. You have this group of characters and you can do with them what you want, but you don't want to break them either.
That's exactly right. I'm terrified. I've killed off a few characters on the periphery of things. I screwed up all my courage and the family dog died a year ago. And I know because time is passing, others have to die, but I'm terrified of doing it. And I'm terrified of, terrified might be too strong a word, but I'm so reluctant to stop it, not only because I love it, but because I want to know what happens to this family, to this mom and dad and these two kids. And the only way I can know is to write it. And you can snort and say, well, then just make it up and close the book and be gone. But I can make up one ending today, but unless I've read it and written it and put it on the radio, it really hasn't happened. So I could wake up the next day and say, yes, but.
Can you talk about how the stories evolve from where they start with the with what you do on the radio? Are you revising constantly by doing these out loud?
Yeah, they start. It's an interesting process. It's hard, because after you've done this sort of thing for a while, you work along at a certain level. And then you, one day, through some fluke of the universe, some alignment of the stars, you write a story which is slightly better than the ones you've written before. And now you're not happy unless every story is like that. And then you march along at that level for a while. And then you do it again to yourself, continually lifting the bar on yourself. So instead of it getting continually easier, it gets continually harder because you're not happy or nothing. So starting becomes harder and harder because you know when you start, the height of the mountain you have to climb. What I usually do these days, I trick myself. I make the start of it easy. So I start with a conversation with my editor. We talk on the phone for a couple hours and I take notes and we kick around ideas, which is a really pleasant way of spending time. We've worked together for 20 years, so we have some laughs, and I look forward to these conversations. But at the end of this easy conversation, I've already got stuff on paper, so I've begun. And then the process just becomes writing, and I count words. I want to get 500 words done a day. Nora Ephron once told a wonderful story about a book dealer phoning her and telling her he had a page of a Mark Twain manuscript. And she said, I'm not coming to look at it. You're just tricking me to buy it. He said, I don't have any money. And he said, no, I just want you to see it. And she said, well, I'll come, but I'm not buying it. And when she got there and he showed on the page of whatever it was he was writing, he said, we love this thing, except he said, the only thing we can't figure about it is why. What are these little numbers in the margins? And she said, oh, that's easy. He was counting words. He was getting paid by the word. And they said, come on, this is Mark Twain. He didn't care about that sort of stuff. And of course, they counted the words and they found out that's exactly what he was doing. I'm not paid by the word, but I don't let myself off until I've written 500 words each day. And eventually you get a story of about, 5,000 words, and then you edit it down, and you land it at about 4,000. And then I start telling it in theaters, which we do before we record it. It's first a collaboration between me and my editor, and then it becomes a collaboration between me and the audience as I learn what works and what doesn't work from the intensity of their response in that moment of giving and receiving and through the silences or the laughter. And you constantly revise until you can't anymore.
Does there have to be a balance between comic timing as it works out loud and comic timing as it kind of comes off the page to someone who's just reading it to themselves?
It's totally written for the ear and totally written to be done in a theater out loud. And then it gets into its polished shape and delivered. And then after it's had its moment in the theatrical sun, I collect these stories over the years. And then when I've got 20 or 25 stories, I'll put them in a book. And then they're all rewritten for the book. And it gets re-massaged into a literary piece rather than an oral piece.
You include editorial notes at the beginning of each story, which are entertaining on their own, frankly. And the one that sticks with me from the latest book is at the start of the story called The Phone Message, which you describe as, and I'm quoting here, a tale of desperation that, despite some very fine writing, stretches even the author's credulity and should have, in his opinion, been left out of this volume, as no doubt many will agree. It is a very funny story, and you've obviously included it. But do you ever worry about pushing the envelope with these characters too much and delving into things that might be better handled on a sitcom?
The stories have been compared to The Simpsons, some of them, in a critical piece that was written in the Walrus magazine here in Canada, thoughtful piece. And there is certainly in some of the stories a slapstick, cartoonish or sitcomish nature. And those are the stories which are the most fun to read in public, because there's nothing better than standing on a stage by yourself and recounting a story and having 2,000 people convulsed with laughter. It's like surfing, or it's like what I imagine surfing would be like, because you know when you have a funny line coming and you hold it back and then you put it out there and the wave of laughter comes and you ride it. You kind of time it just before it breaks and launch into the next, and you hop from wave of laughter to the next wave of laughter. So it's very tempting as a writer to stay there. But it's dangerous too, because it's asking your audience to stay in a hysterical state. While it's tempting and the most fun, it's kind of dessert all the time. And the ones that I really like are the more heartfelt stories. I love moments of silence in the theater. I love the deep silence that you sometimes get. When you, as E.B. White said, he talks about how humor has this added dimension, which can take a person to that place where their emotions can't be trusted, where laughter and tears meet, and you find yourself laughing and crying at the same moment. White goes on to say that it can do this because its humor has an added dimension, like poetry, and when it does it, it takes the reader close to the big hot fire that is truth, and sometimes they feel the heat. Those are my most favorite moments, and those moments are usually met with silence, and I just love those moments in the theater where when the shuffling stops and the coughing stops and the babies stop crying and you feel as if you're in a room full of 2,000 people who are floating in some kind of black void, and you feel a deep connection then.
What a beautiful image. With that in mind, I was hoping maybe you could share at least part of a story with us. This is a story called The Phone Message, and perhaps one of the more slapsticky stories in your latest collection, but I was hoping you might share it with us.
This is the setup to the story. It's about 2 pages, so it'll take a minute or two here to read. It sets up the story to follow, but it may give people who've never heard of the Vinyl Cafe a good feel for how things roll along. This is the phone message. It began simply enough. It began with a phone call, or a phone message, actually. Dave came home and the message light was blinking, so he picked up the phone, the cordless phone, and that part's important. He was thinking maybe it was his wife, Morley. He was walking around the kitchen with the phone to his ear the way you do when you're a bit keyed up, flipping through the mail, opening the fridge, pacing. He walked into the living room, then over to the kitchen window, not really paying attention to the phone, and that part's important too. That part's maybe the most important part. If, that is, you're interested in the archaeology of the infamous events that unfolded at Dave's house on the night in question, if you're interested in sorting out the spaces between cause and effect, the fact that Dave wasn't paying attention is key, because it wasn't his wife Morley who had left the message that Dave was only half listening to. It was Dave's nemesis, his neighbor from 2 houses down, Mary Turlington. It was Friday evening. Mary had called just before she and her husband Bert had left town. Her message said, "We're away for the weekend, but we're having a dinner party next Saturday. We'd love you to come." Dave was thinking as he listened to Mary's precise and insistent voice that he would rather have his legs waxed than go to another dinner party at Mary Turlington's house. And that's when things began to happen too fast, things that caused Dave to lose his focus. Dave was in the kitchen, sort of listening to Mary Turlington's message, when all hell broke loose. Morley blew through the back door with her arms full of groceries. Sam burst through the front door with 2 friends. The cat began to yowl for her supper. And, well, you don't need all the details. You just need to know that things got confusing for a moment. And Dave, who wasn't paying attention, hung up the phone, or meant to hang up the phone. The phone, being cordless, requires a person to push a button to hang it up, and in attempting to hang up, Dave pushed the wrong button. He pressed the callback button. So instead of hanging up, Dave called Mary Turlington, or more to the point, Dave's phone called Mary's message machine, and Dave, who was holding the phone in his hand, waving it in front of him like a microphone, said to Morley, who was unloading the groceries on the counter, "Mary Turlington has invited us to a dinner party." Dave dragged out the word party derisively, as if Mary had invited him over to deworm their dog. He didn't stop there. He kept going. "She says there will be interesting people, which means there will be name tags, which means she decides where we sit, and there won't be enough food. There's never enough food, and she never opens the wine anyone brings." It's true, she doesn't. The Turlington served Bert's homemade wine, and Bert's homemade wine tastes like car wax. And Dave didn't stop there. Dave kept going. Dave said, "I'd rather have my nose pierced than go to another party at the Turlingtons." And that is when the phone receiver that Dave was waving around beeped twice. Dave looked down at the phone, perplexed. That didn't last long. In an instant, realizing what he had just done, Dave was staring at the phone in terror. He had just left Mary Turlington a message.
And
the story goes on to recount how Dave tries desperately over the weekend to break into the Turlington. Well, he just comes up with all of these different ways of trying to erase the message in the Turlington's house, trying to break their secret code, renting a huge magnet and trying to go around their house with this magnet, and ends with him being stuck to their gutter, I think, with his pants at his ankles.
It is a funny story, but within the same book, there are some stories where I have to admit I get a little choked up reading them, and of course I'm reading them on the bus, and you know, maybe it's the fine line that you were talking about between comedy and tragedy, but I find myself looking around to make sure no one's noticing me.
Well, you see, that's the whole point of these stories, is that you don't have to worry if somebody's noticing you. That's, and maybe this brings us back to where we begin. I'm trying to say that we all feel things deeply, and that we all pretty much feel the same thing. We all want to laugh and cry, and we want to do it with the ones that we love, and we want to know that we're safe to do that, and that it's okay to do that and to feel those things. And I'm trying in my stories, I think, to say that it is.
Well, Stuart McLean, I thank you so much for your time and for sharing these stories and your own story with us.
Thank you for having me, and thank you for your thoughtful questions.
Stuart McLean is the author of Secrets from the Vinyl Cafe, published in the U.S. by Riverhead. He's host of The Vinyl Cafe, which airs on the CBC in Canada and a few public radio stations in the United States. We reached him via Skype from his office in Toronto. There's a link to The Vinyl Cafe podcast from WUWM.com/likeeffect. I'm Mitch Teich. That is also where you can find a link to our very own podcast, where you can relive individual segments or full shows at your convenience, plus hear some web-exclusive extras. That's WUWM.com/likeeffect. Thanks so much for tuning in today, and I hope you can be with us again tomorrow and every weekday morning at 10 for Lake Effect from WUWM and WUWM HD1, Milwaukee Public Radio. Stay tuned. Fresh Air is next.